border of Bolivia, working for pennies, treated like a slave. The coca fields have to be ready. The spirit of my people is starving, broken and sweaty, dreaming about revolution, looking at my machete. But the workload is too heavy to rise up in arms, and if I ran away, I know they'd probably murder my moms.
Okay, listen, Juan Valdez, just get me my product before we chop off your hands for workers' misconduct. I got the power to shoot a copper and not get charged, and it would be sad to see your family in front of a firing squad. So the
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is George Grayson, a professor of comparative politics at the College of William and Mary. He's written more than 20 books, including The North American Free Trade Agreement, Regional Community and the New World Order, Oil and Mexican Foreign Policy, Mexican Messiah, Andres Manuel López Obrador, and his latest book, The Executioner's Men, Los Zetas, Rogue Soldiers, Criminal Entrepreneurs. He's also an associate scholar of the Foreign Policy Research Institute and writes a weekly column for the Mexican magazine Milenio Semanal. Welcome to Background Briefing, George Grayson.
Very nice to be with you.
And there's a brand new president in Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto, 46 years old, known better for his good looks than his deep thinking. But it looks like he's entering office in the last, he's just entered office with fairly favorable economic and political conditions. That's assuming, of course, that the U.S. Congress gets its acts together. If they do make a deal, most economists think that the U.S. economy could pick up by at least 3%. And since trade with the U.S., Mexico's trade with the U.S. accounts for 82% of its exports, that should be good for Mexico, right?
Absolutely. But the cabinet he has appointed has a number of people who are eager to promote foreign trade, but also diversify export markets, because Mexico is 80% dependent on the U.S. And every time a new chief executive comes into office, he says we've got to have a more varied portfolio of international consumers.
So, obviously, they don't like being dependent upon the United States, but they are benefiting from high commodity prices. And my understanding is that the gap between Chinese and Mexican wages has narrowed considerably. So, how does that stand?
That's correct. And so, the Mexicans are hoping to take advantage of opportunities in the international market.
So give us a sense then of the cabinet that Peña Nieto has put together. I mean, there's been a lot of skepticism about him because he is representing the PRI party, which is a notoriously corrupt and authoritarian institution. Its very name, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, is a strange kind of oxymoron. And they ruled Mexico almost as long as the Communist Party of the Soviet Union ruled the Soviet Union, and perhaps there were some analogies there, but we're talking about supposedly a new modern pre-party. So how much is he shedding the baggage of the old pre?
The pre has no discernible ideology, and so its orientation is whatever the incumbent president says it is. And I think you're right that Peña Nieto would never be confused with a Rhodes Scholar, but he has one advantage, and that is he knows what he doesn't know, and he's got the self-assurance to complement these gaps in his preparation by bringing in highly competent people. And so that's something that augurs well for Mexico, and the cabinet really is outstanding. And one example is he's got a crafty old former governor from Mexico State who's going to be the education secretary. And he's going to take on the education union, which has colonized public schools in Mexico. Its leader, Elbester Gordillo, was once called a Jimmy Hoffa in a skirt. And she is tough as nails, and this is going to be a knockdown, drag-out fight to try to impose national standards and greater transparency in the teaching profession. Because as things now stand, you buy your teacher's job or you buy your job to be in a posh Mexico City suburb, and it's highly politicized.
Well, again, I'm speaking with George Grayson, Professor of Comparative Politics at the College of William & Mary. He's written more than 20 books, largely about Mexico, oil and Mexican foreign policy, and Mexican messiah Andrés Manuel López Obrador. His latest is The Executioner's Men, Los Zetas, Rogue Soldiers and Criminal Entrepreneurs. He's also Associate Research Scholar of the Foreign Policy Research Institute and writes a weekly column for the Mexican magazine Milenio Semanal. And we're talking about the ascension of the new president of Mexico a few days ago, Peña Nieto, and the kind of political and economic landscape he's facing. Now, he's going to benefit, I guess, from the Mexican Congress's in its final days under former President Felipe Calderón. Apparently, they restricted labor rights, well, depending on how you interpret it. It could be called labor reform, but the long and the short of it is it's made it easier for companies to hire and fire workers in Mexico. Fill us in on that, if you will.
That's right. Mexico's labor law went back to 1951, and there just was no opportunity to accomplish mobility within the workforce. And regrettably, the unions are as corrupt as any unions in the world. And my dad was a Teamster, and I'm not anti-union. But there was just immobility with respect to being able to move employees from one job to another, change their shifts, promote them in a basis on merit as opposed to just simply the number of years they had been at work. However, the union bosses got something out of this, and that is there are not open elections for union leaders. These take place with raised hands, and so if you're a petroleum worker or a teacher or a railroad worker, your boss of the union knows exactly for whom you voted, and there will be retribution if you don't vote according to his desires.
So how is this going to translate then in terms of the Mexican economy? I mean, if you say there's more job mobility, does that mean in any way that people's job security or their pensions, et cetera, have been affected?
No, that their pensions are safe, but the ability to fire someone who is just outrageously incompetent is quite limited. And it still is limited, but employers will have a bit more discretion. But if they want to move a part of their workforce from one plant to another, they really have to arm wrestle the union to get such approval. They'll have more flexibility, and they'll also have more flexibility in hiring and in promotions. So the business community is by and large satisfied with the deal and the fact that the average union members don't get to elect democratically their leaders is just their problem.
So again, George Grayson, expert on Mexico, writes for the Mexican magazine Milenio Semanal and the author of The Executioner's Men, Los Zetas, Rogue Soldiers and Criminal Entrepreneurs. Let's turn to that subject that you've written about recently, George, and that is, of course, this failed war on drugs. We here in California have just had an incident off the Channel Islands off Santa Barbara where a Coast Guard officer was killed by a couple of Mexican drug smugglers, or assumed to be drug smugglers, in an open sort of skiff that they rammed the Coast Guard, which is a pretty brazen act, which makes you realize the sort of thorough brutality of this war. Now, it has claimed the life of one American Coast Guard officer. Of course, it's claimed the life of how many thousands of Mexicans?
I think the count as of this weekend was 47,500. But that doesn't include those who are missing or those who have been displaced.
And how many? What's the percentage of those people that have been killed that are innocent victims, as opposed to inter-gang criminal murders?
It won't surprise you to say that the government doesn't release those kinds of figures. The government talks in terms of 95% being in the underworld or being police officers or military cadres or judges, but we simply don't know, and human rights organizations place the percentage much higher.
Percentage of what? The innocence?
The percentage of those who have died in the drug war who are non-combatants.
I see.
Who suffer what the Pentagon euphemistically calls collateral damage.
So what's in terms of this new cabinet then that the new president of Mexico has, what can you tell us about their attitude to the war on drugs? My understanding is that the fact that in the most recent election here in the United States, the states of Colorado and Washington moved to legalize marijuana for recreational use, that's given a little bit of wind in the sails of those in Central and South America who've been arguing for the longest time that the U.S. war on drugs has failed and that they have to come up with a new plan.
Peña Nieto's first, second, and third priorities are reducing the amount of bloodshed. And to that end, he wants to form a 40,000-member gendarmerie that would be headed by civilians but would be made up largely of Army and Navy personnel. And one of the possible barriers to that is that the new Secretary of Navy is young, bright, modern, and he's eager to cooperate with the United States. In contrast, Peña Nieto has named the most senior general in the Army to become the new Secretary of Defense, and he's a traditionalist who really blanches at the idea of close cooperation with Uncle Sam. So that may impede the formation of this gendarmerie and also exacerbate inter-service rivalries.
Well, but closer cooperation with the United States, you mentioned in terms of this young admiral in charge of the Navy, the Mexican Navy, that doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to have a more enlightened approach. I mean, my understanding is that the U.S. is stuck on this militarized war on drugs and that they're very inflexible in terms of coming up with new ways to reduce demand here in the United States, because we're really the problem. We're the market. That's where the drugs end up. That's where the money is made. That's where the money is then shipped into Mexico along with a bunch of high-powered weapons.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I think the United States is giving Peña Nieto complete freedom of action as he configures his version of the war on drugs. But I think it's going to be with smaller forces that are mobile and that make use of state-of-the-art technology, that employ eavesdroppers and informants. But there has to be substantial emphasis on the money flows, because that obviously is the propeller that drives the drug aircraft. And if you can get a handle on the money flows and reduce those even marginally, you can hurt the dons, the mafiosi, where it really does the most damage, and that's in their bank accounts.
So the other issue, of course, that's both important here north of the border in the United States and south of the border is the issue of immigration. And there is a possibility, I think the Republican Party haven't learned a lot from this last election, except that they've alienated Latinos, the growing demographic here in the United States. And then a lot of the more sensible voices in the Republican Party are saying that we've got to do something about that, or the Republicans have to do something about that. So there's an indication that there may be a deal in the works in terms of immigration reform here in the United States. What's your sense of that?
Well, I have a little bit different view, and that is I think Mexico is one of the wealthiest countries in the world, that if Singapore could lease Mexico for 20 years, we would be talking about the Colossus of the South and would be buying pogo sticks to jump the wall. And the problem is not that I'm at all hostile to people who want to improve their lives, but the Mexican elite don't give a tired rat's derriere about their poor people. So they collect little in taxes, have a substandard educational system, have poor health care for the masses, don't promote job creation programs, much less regional development. And I think the Mexicans should be doing more to, say, pull up their socks with regard to their poor and not export them or hope they can solve the problem by exporting them to the United States, because you see the economic problems in California, which have certainly been sharpened and exacerbated by the number of legal and illegal immigrants who've come from not just Mexico, but from all over the world.
Well, just in closing, George Grayson, as the earlier PAN president, Vicente Fox, was ridiculed because he promised 10 million jobs. And the joke was, yes, he promised 10 million jobs, but they're all in the United States. And there's no question that Mexico exports its poor to the United States, but there's also no question that agribusiness and others here in the United States, restaurants, etc., take advantage of these low wages. So what kind of deal can be made? Because it has to be done on both sides.
I couldn't agree with you more. And the elite in this country, the United States, is really out of touch with the masses. The masses, and this is whether you're talking about African-Americans, Mexican-Americans, or Anglo-Americans, they want to see immigration laws enforced and, if anything, tightened. But your big shots in Washington in the Republican Party want to appeal to the growers, the ranchers, the hotel chains, the restaurant chains, and so forth. And the Democrats, and I'm sure there are some people with humanitarian spirits motivating their action, but the Democrats want more brown people in the United States because they're more likely, once they get citizenship, to vote Democratic. And so this is a classic example of where the elite and the masses in the United States have totally different views. And they're like two ships crossing in the night.
Well, George Grayson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with George Grayson, who's a professor of comparative politics at the College of William & Mary. He's written more than 20 books, including The North American Free Trade Agreement, Regional Community, and The New World Order, Oil and Mexican Foreign Policy, Mexican Messiah, Andres Manuel López Obrador, and his latest book is The Executioner's Men, Los Zetas, Rogue Soldiers, and Criminal Entrepreneurs. He's also an associate scholar of the Foreign Policy Research Institute and writes a weekly column for the Mexican magazine Milenio Semanal. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and answer some of your questions of late. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/IanMastersMedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.